I'm sitting here with Thomas DiLorenzo, professor at Loyola College in Baltimore, and he's teaching at the Mises University on a variety of topics, but you took a short trip to New Orleans yesterday, did you, to give another talk?
Yes, I did. I spoke at a convention there, and I spoke about my forthcoming book, Lincoln Unmasked, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Dishonest Abe, which is sort of a sequel to The Real Lincoln, my earlier book.
Uh-huh.
And so, and since it was New Orleans, sort of not unexpectedly, I had a standing ovation from 600 people, including a few rebel yells in the back of the room.
That's really funny. So the anti-government attitudes are pretty intense these days in New Orleans. Right?
Well, in New Orleans, they certainly were. I came back with a T-shirt that has big black letters of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Association, on the top, and then a long line of cuss words underneath that everyone so far I've showed it to has gotten a good laugh out of it. But I guess the one good thing that's come out of the hurricane down there is that people hate and despise FEMA and the federal government for what they've done. Not only that, but people I talked to fully understand that it was the Army Corps of Engineers' screw-up with the dike system that caused the disaster. It wasn't the hurricane per se. Everybody I talked to knew this, and they all knew that the Corps of Engineers spun this for about 6 months, and then after the news died down, they admitted it. They admitted, well, we goofed. We didn't build a good enough system to protect the people from this hurricane, but that was sort of page 28 news by that point.
Yeah.
And they understood that. I talked to these really ordinary people. They weren't scientists or academics or libertarians like us. They were just ordinary working people who I talked to that understood this.
It's, I guess the message hasn't gotten out to the general population, but wasn't there some kind of, didn't FEMA, or was it the Army Corps of Engineers, that issued a report, actually, it was a huge study, and they basically...
That it would not withstand a Category 5 hurricane?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
But this is one after everything that came out and sort of assessed, the government's response.
Oh,
I
guess
this is what government does, right? When there's a disaster, they hire they assign a committee to kind of look into things.
Yeah, they assign a committee to I remember reading this news article, and it was an eye-opener because they did admit it was our fault, but I think the way in which they're going to use it, of course, is to say, well, therefore, we need a bigger budget.
Right.
We need more money, because that's how government always operates. Failure is success. When you fail spectacularly like this, they probably will double or triple or quadruple their budget, just as though when NASA blows up a space shuttle, I think they literally did double NASA's budget last time they did that. They had a big accident.
Yeah, it's proof that government failures end up being proof that the taxpayers are too stingy and aren't willing to cough up enough.
Yeah, that's what I always tell my students. If you think about the incentives, if you're wondering why it is that government so-called services are so poor, well, the incentives are completely backwards. Failure is success in government. In the private sector, if you serve consumers well, you're rewarded. It's just the opposite.
Is there an in-between solution somewhere between the privatization of all this public infrastructure and the current system? Is there anything that, because people might say, look, clearly the solution is a private ownership of the levies, but how likely is that?
Well, it's not too likely. That being there yesterday, just picking up the local paper in New Orleans, that the government bureaucrats and their contractors are still working feverishly day and night, literally, on these levees because we're entering the peak of the hurricane season right now this year.
Yeah.
And so the government is gaining a big stronghold and taking over this rebuilding of the levees right now. So
busy preventing the last disaster.
Yeah, busy showing that. Hopefully there will not be another hurricane for many years hitting New Orleans. But in the meantime, they'll have all these bureaucrats swarming around down there saying, "We are protecting you." I had thought about this, when this happened, but a lot of the ordinary working people that I talked to, and among this crowd at the convention, there were just people from all walks of life, and they weren't academics. It wasn't an academic convention. But they understood that at the Superdome, you remember seeing on television all these people crowded into the Superdome.
It was ghastly.
They said there were thousands and thousands of automobiles parked around the Superdome that these people drove to the Superdome in, and so they could have left. But my take on it is these are people who were so conditioned to being taken care of by the government. The government told them, go to the Superdome, and that's what they did. And they didn't have the wherewithal a day earlier to say, let's get out of here, like ordinary people would have done.
Yeah.
But all these people who have been on, you know, generations of welfare are so used to being just told what to do and taken care of by somebody. Yeah. Well, they couldn't do what animals would do to escape a fire, yeah, or something like that.
My impression, too, was that they were actually being kept there. Or maybe it was a mixture. There were National Guard people.
Oh, yeah, at some point. Once they were there, you're not going to leave.
Once you're in there, yeah, you're not going anywhere.
The place, and kidnapped.
You know, doesn't it seem true that every time there's an emergency, there's always these official-looking people that sort of emerge, or somebody willing to take on the role of telling everybody what to do. You know, go here, go there. Yeah.
It seems
to be increasingly part of the culture of emergency in the U.S., where there's these little stormtroopers, you know, sort of come out of nowhere. I mean, even around here, there was a case, I think last year, that there was a little bit of lightning or a thunderstorm or something like that, and we had one of those FEMA alarm systems that went off, and immediately everybody was held in wherever you were, all over town.
Really?
Yeah.
Couldn't go anywhere.
Yeah, in public libraries, you weren't allowed to leave.
Yeah. Well, we've become a nation of sheep, I guess, with all these years of statism we've been suffering under. And the post 9/11 era has sped this up, I think, a great deal. You just walk through the airports like I've done in the last week four or five times, and everybody's yelling. Even the private airline employees are yelling at you now on the airlines to do this and do that. It seems to me it was only like the Transportation Security Administration bureaucrats who are always yelling at her, do this, do that, stand in this line. And now you even have the flight attendants has sort of taken on that persona, and people just. Listen, they just do what they're told. I was on a flight some time ago, and it was a 7 a.m. flight, so 7:15, something like an early morning flight. So you get up very early to get on this airplane, and the pilot announces that there's some minor mechanical problem, so we're going to sit there for an hour or an hour and a half. And he's apologizing, making all kinds of excuses, and he's trying to smooth things over. And so it comes back to where the passengers are and says, well, anybody have any questions? And I was the only one who spoke up, and I said, yeah, why didn't they fix this last night when it was sitting on the tarmac? Why did you wait till we got on the airplane? And there were people looking at me with shock and horror because they thought, well, the air marshal was going to come and drag me off. I spoke back to the pilot.
Yeah.
But no one else said anything. I think that was the obvious question. I mean, they're a business, and they inconvenience their customers tremendously.
Right.
You know, there were all sorts of business people on that thing. They were buzzing away on their cell phones, cussing, I'm going to miss this big meeting, and who knows how much money they lost because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is true. It probably had something to do with the unions, that they didn't want to, they probably have a union contract where they won't work before 7 a.m. or something
that,
I would guess.
Yeah.
But it struck me that, you know, no one would have spoken up about that.
And probably over-the-top regulations concerning the instruments on the panel. You know,
sure.
One thing is even slightly...
Yeah, I guess if the FAA bureaucrat wasn't on the job at that hour, they couldn't have done it at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m.
Yeah,
without the government's permission.
It does seem that the culture has, the political culture, and just generally things have really... 9/11 represented something like a turning point, didn't it?
Yeah, I remember emailing our good friend Professor Ralph Rako the very eloquent message of we're screwed after 9/11, because anyone who's ever read Robert Higgs's book Crisis and Leviathan,
mm-hmm,
would have anticipated exactly what the state was going to do. Was going to explode in terms of the building of bigger and new bureaucracies and taxes and rules and regulations and restrictions on our travel, and that's exactly what has happened.
But just
and we're no safer.
Just to show you how naive I am, I've read the book, but after 9/11 I thought, well, that's what happens with our interventionist foreign policy. Maybe at long last somebody's going to see this and we'll do something about it.
Yeah.
That didn't happen.
Yeah, well, unfortunately... Yeah, unfortunately, the voices that would articulate that correct argument are too few and not quite as powerful. That doesn't mean they always will be in that state, but But as I've said in some of my other writings, you know, as you know, Jeff, I've written books on such topics as tax-funded politics, of how government writes checks to special interest groups that use the money then to lobby for bigger government. Yeah. And what that sort of creates is a system of when a big issue like this comes up, the government does have the ability to drown out all other voices if it wants to, yeah, on an issue like this. So even though there are great reasons to believe that this is our foreign policy is the root cause of this,
yeah,
so far it's been drowned out by the terrorizing of the population, by not by the terrorists, but by our own government.
Yeah,
just
yeah,
the other day, here at Mises U, and I ran back to my condo and turned on the television news. There was a map of the United States on the Fox News Channel, and the lettering below it, and it had about 30 stars on the different cities in the map all over the country that were blinking off and on, and underneath it, it said, Hezbollah terror cells in America. And I looked at that, and I'm thinking, well, if the government knows where these terror cells are exactly, that they can pinpoint them on a map, why don't they go get them? Or if they do, if I was a terrorist and I saw that map, I'd get out of town. So it struck me that it had to be made up. How do they know there's terror cells in Dubuque, Iowa, and Seattle, Washington, and all that? And if they did know, why aren't they doing anything about it? And why would they reveal to the terrorists that they know where they are? It doesn't make any sense at all.
No.
And so the only thing that makes sense is they're trying to use the current war in Lebanon to stir up more fear in the minds of Americans, so they can grab more power over us. Mm-hmm. Because that map was just totally stupid. It's inconceivable, yeah, that was true.
The same thing with it. You remember all the color-coded nonsense where, you know, on Thursday would be a red alert,
yes,
and a Friday would be a yellow alert or whatever.
Yeah, then they changed it and confused everybody, yeah, I think it was.
It just became perfectly ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
there's the assumption that somehow the government's privy to special kinds of information and special plans that are going to secure us that other people don't have.
Yes. Yeah, we're from the government and we're here to help you.
Right.
There's no, as long as enough people believe in that, they'll continue to control us. But what you just said reminds me of something our old friend Yuri Maltsev said when I first met him. He came here from Russia in the late 80s, and I started asking him questions about what are some of the biggest differences between life in the Soviet Union, where he grew up until middle age, and life in America now that you've been here a couple of years. And he said he couldn't believe how everyone believes just about everything the government says here, whereas in the Soviet Union, no one believed anything the politicians said over there for his entire life. They just went along with it because there was nothing they could do about it.
Yeah.
But as long as we have this childish attitude that our parents are in Washington, D.C., no matter how old we are, they'll keep controlling and abusing us like that.
How much of a contribution do you think you've made to helping a broad sector of the public to rethink the Lincoln question?
Well, I don't have any scientific measurement. I know I've sold a lot of books. My book is being used at quite a few universities, even if it's being used as a foil where a professor will use it and then criticize it all semester.
Mm-hmm.
They're still making the students read the book. And everywhere I go, I've given lots of speeches all over the country to all kinds of groups, mostly student groups. I've had dozens of invitations to go to universities, and they always come from the students, never from the professors, because
mm-hmm.
it's a little too politically incorrect, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But the students love it. They love having someone come on campus and say things that they know some of their professors will disagree with, because they're kind of tired of being fed political correctness day in, day out in the classroom. But I know there are a lot of new books coming out. In my next book, Lincoln Unmasked, the final chapter is called Contra the Lincoln Cult. And it's basically about a number of authors who are not professional Lincoln scholars, but who have nevertheless written books either about Lincoln or part of a book about Lincoln that basically agree with my interpretation of the whole thing. And one of them is James Webb, the former U.S. Navy Secretary, who wrote a book on the history of the Scots-Irish in America. And he has a big section, since the Scotch-Irish overwhelmingly settled in the South and were very heavily represented in the Confederate Army in what I call the war to prevent Southern independence, he provides some pretty good arguments. There's a man named Stephen Weissman, who's a New York Times editorial writer, who wrote a book on the history of the income tax. And he has a big section on Lincoln's income tax and the Civil War. And I invoke what he says. He gives my same interpretation. John Steele Gordon, who's a very well-known popular historian, I invoke him. There's a book called Lincoln's Wrath that was published last year that talks about Lincoln's crackdown and demolition of civil liberties in the northern states during the war. And there's even a book called Slavery in New York that was recently published about a history of slavery in New York. Most Americans don't know that slavery existed in the northern states for 300 years and didn't end in New Jersey until 1865. And I'm not taking credit for all these books, but what I would take credit for is I think I sort of took the first step and was one of the first to dare to write a book that would challenge this. And I think it has made it and will make it a little easier for other authors to go further and explore some of this. You know, and I get thousands of emails from people, thousands, who will send me, read this article, look what this guy says about Lincoln, and they'll laugh at it. Yeah. And so I have created a laugh. Lou Rockwell told me, after he watched me give a speech in front of a large audience, he shook his head and he said, "It's amazing. You can get people to belly laugh over something Abraham Lincoln says." Whereas, you know, years ago, people would act like they were in church whenever somebody would quote something from Abraham Lincoln.
That's remarkable. one of the things that's really great about your method here is that you're able to write commercially successful books, which is not easy.
Yes.
But also make them rigorous from a scholarly point of view. Mm-hmm. I mean, rigorously persuasive. You know, mm-hmm. that's not easy. There's not many people who can manage that.
No, I've been working at that my whole life, pretty much. Uh-huh. When I was a college student, I thought Milton Friedman and James Buchanan were among my best, my sort of role models as far as writers, because mm-hmm. I thought they both had really good techniques for explaining things. And in addition to being, you know, eventually Nobel Prize winning economists. And so even as a young student, I worked hard at trying to imitate some of the better writing styles of some of the economists I was reading. Mm-hmm. And of course, Rothbard was good at that in his popular writing. I always think of some of what I do is, you know, Murray's work on America's Great Depression. It's very dense with footnotes, but you can read it. It's readable. Right. And the Austrians in general have always been, that's one of the big differences between the Austrian school and the mainstream, is they haven't fallen into scientism as much as the rest of the profession has.
It's tough to find even a publisher that will look at books of the sort that you're doing. How did you manage that?
Well, The Real Lincoln, actually, I had published an article in the Independent Review called The Great Centralizer. And then I looked at that article and I said, I can turn this into a book. I'm going to do more research. And I just took each section of that article and expanded my research and my writing. And I did this over a summer. And it was the end of the summer, and I was pretty much done. I had a manuscript there. And I got a phone call from a publisher, from a publishing company that was affiliated with Random House, who said, I read your article in the Independent Review. Would you consider turning this into a book? And I said, yes, I would. And in fact, I just did that. I just So I sent them that, and they published it. And then it sold very well, as you know. It created a big controversy. Yeah. And there have even been magazine articles about my current publisher, Crown Forum, that I have someone sent me that about the magazine business, about the publishing business, that actually points to this book as one of the early successes of this whole enterprise, where the Random House decided to devote a few resources to publishing conservative books. They call them conservative books. Uh-huh. And they highlighted mine as one of the first successes they had.
Yeah, it's very conservative. Book.
Yes, the magazine writers don't know what libertarian conservative is. And of course, the big seller of my publisher is Ann Coulter. She's her latest book is also published by them. And God bless Anne. She sold 500,000 copies in about a week, and so maybe I can ask for a bigger advance next time. Now that I know they're loaded, but that's how I got connected with this division of Random House, Crown Forum, and And so, and they've published my capitalism book, How Capitalism Saved America, and I just sent them a proposal for another book that they said, we like it, and we'll get back to you shortly about details.
This is another.
Well, they're publishing my third, second Lincoln book. They've published two of them. They published The Real Lincoln, How Capitalism Saved America, and then this one, Lincoln Unmasked, comes out in October.
Right.
And I just sent them a fourth proposal, and my editor said, I like it, and I'll get back to you, because they, like every business, they do things by committee.
And have you mentioned what that fourth proposal is?
No, it's the proposal I sent them is a book called Hamilton's Curse. And the subtitle I'm still working on, it's something like Why Jefferson's Arch Enemy Disavowed the American Revolution, something catchy like that.
Ah.
And the title comes from, I got the idea from John Steele Gordon has a book called Hamilton's Blessing, where he argues that the public debt has been a blessing to America.
Oh.
And so I'm looking much closer at Hamilton in terms of his economic ideas. And I think he is the main source of so many bad ideas that have come to fruition in America. He was a champion of corporate welfare, central banking, business and politics being linked, protectionism, the idea that there are implied powers in the Constitution that aren't actually written down. That was Hamilton's idea that Justice John Marshall ran with and has plagued us ever since. He was a big tax increaser. He championed public debt. And so as a free market economist, you can't see a good economic idea anywhere in Hamilton. But, of course, America has been one big battle between the philosophies of Hamilton and Jefferson. And in recent years, there have been quite a few big books written that lionize Hamilton and demonize Jefferson. And so I argued to my publishers in my proposal that I think I'm uniquely qualified to do something like this, because the only historian who has ever written about Hamilton who claims economic expertise is Forrest MacDonald. And he's a historian. He's not an economist. And he does have more of an economic background than most historians, but still not very good. He gets a lot of Hamilton's economics wrong. He's a champion of Hamilton. He thinks he's great. But Hamilton's economic ideas were universally terrible from my perspective. And so I'm proposing to... sort of each chapter after I get through the introductory material will be, here's what went on during in Hamilton's day with his big debate with Jefferson or whoever over these issues. And then I want to trace through in the same kind of language that I use in my other books, what happened once we did get Hamiltonian central banking, what has been the record of central banking? And then I'm going to make a case against central banking hopefully in a readable form. And then his protectionism. He was sort of the champion of protectionism. How has America fared over the years with that?
Yeah. It's an interesting strain of thought, because you did the same thing, of course, with the whole your studies of Henry Clay and the Lincoln period.
Yeah, there is a tie. There was the mercantilist in America. The leaders of the mercantilism in America historically were Hamilton, then Clay, then Lincoln, and then the Republican Party in general in the late 19th century. And then Roosevelt, when FDR came around, the New Deal was the neo-mercantilism with all the wage codes that propped up prices and things like that were his version of mercantilism. And so, but Hamilton remains the patron saint of all this.
Yeah.
And but I don't think the average American has any understanding of this. You might know there was a big debate between Hamilton and Jefferson, but I think it has a lot more economic meaning.
Has your opinion of the Federalist Papers changed at all as you've done your studies?
Actually, one of the things I'm planning on getting into in this book, Hamilton's Curse, is looking at how the way I've come to see it is that the Constitution was a coup against the Jeffersonians, really, and the limited government contingent among the founding fathers, as Albert J. Knox said in his work. He said it was a bloodless coup that opened the door to centralized governmental power especially giving the central government the power to tax. That was sort of the beginning of the end of liberty in America, in my view. I guess it's all relative. You know, compared to what we've got today, if you were to enforce the Constitution, we would be better off in terms of freedom and prosperity. But we would be even better off yet if we had never had the Constitution and stuck with the Articles of Confederation and had a loose confederation and not a centralized state. And so I have changed my mind a bit about that. I've come with all my work on Lincoln and that I think what happened in America now is that the Constitution was a coup d'état that the nationalists succeeded with, and they made all kinds of promises that this Constitution would limit government, don't worry about it. But then they worked diligently to undermine the limits on government that their own constitution would put into place, and John Marshall bears a lot of the blame for that, for talking about implied powers of the Constitution, not real powers, for example. And then I think the war between the states was the final end of that coup d'état, yeah, where we finally cemented into place at gunpoint what the nationalists always wanted. And then from then on, they rewrote the history, and we celebrate nationalism and patriotism and militarism, which is what these people and their political ancestors were always about, in my view.
Did you go to any Fourth of July celebrations this year?
No, I didn't go to any. Unfortunately, I live in downtown Baltimore, and they blew off the fireworks right in front of where I live, and so so my dog was very frightened by them, but she recovered.
Okay.
And I never say the Pledge of Allegiance because I know it was written by a late 19th century socialist whose idea was to indoctrinate into school children obedience to the state.
Yeah.
And so I'll stand up and smile, but I won't put my hand on my heart and say the pledge. In fact, in my new book that comes out in October, I have a chapter called Pledging Allegiance to the Omnipotent Lincolnian State, which is about that episode.
Well, you know, the whole Independence Day idea is a wonderful one, and it's amazing how that whole holiday has been converted into the celebration of the military.
Yeah, and that's why I don't go. I know the meaning of Independence Day. It was our declaration of secession from the British Empire. But
right.
But you're right. It's been turned into one big militaristic state worshiping event. You turn on the television in the evening on July 4th, and you'll see down on the mall in Washington, D.C., with all the military people and the cannons and all that.
And flying over and all this.
Yeah, a Canadian friend of mine, you know, a very pretty song is O Canada. As far as anthems goes, I like O Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And a Canadian friend of mine once remarked, why is, America, bombs bursting in air, why is everything so militaristic and warlike in your anthems? Why and compared to O Canada?
Yeah.
And well, that's our culture. It's been our culture for quite a long time,
I guess. Part of the problem is that many people assume that the American Revolution, the purpose of the American Revolution was to make us ruled by the Constitution instead of a king. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Not understanding that there is a period of time that passes between the revolution and
yes, and that's right. Yes, yeah, and you can't rely on the government schools to teach you that.
Yeah,
people don't understand the whole principle of divided sovereignty, which is what the founders understood. That they set up this system whereby if this central government was to be controlled by the people, the only possible hope for that would be if the people could organize politically at their local or community level or state level to exert control over this central state. It turns out that was not effective, and I argue that the war of 1861 to 1865 was fought to destroy that once and for all, the ability of the people to be the masters rather than the servants of their central government. I think that's the real purpose of the war, and it was accomplished too. And the final nail in the coffin of that was the income tax in 1913, and along with the Fed that was created in the same year, where there really was no more any semblance of the people being in control. Once the government can set a tax rate and tell you how much of your income you may keep, you're not in control.
One of the things I really admire about the way you've handled all of this since your first book on Lincoln came out, is you've been the source of enormous controversy, and many controversies stirred up in all kinds of circles over the book, and yet you stayed on topic. You haven't allowed yourself to get in any sense flustered or disoriented, mm-hmm. or get drawn off into areas you don't want to talk about. You stayed on topic the whole time.
Yeah. Well, that's what you have to do. If you're being criticized, you have to stick with research and facts and logic and arguments, and keep writing and keep at it. And so that's what I tried to do, because I knew this would happen. This is a case of where you have a lot of people who have been very heavily subsidized for a lot of years by big foundations and the government itself to write books, and they give each other awards for their books, and they've intimidated. They've been used to intimidating any intellectual opponents through all sorts of means, name calling, and organized campaigns of character assassination and so forth. So they're not used to being criticized, and they often fall apart when they are criticized effectively. And so when you're in a debate like this, you can see your intellectual opponents becoming unnerved when they resort to name calling. But that's when to jump in and criticize them even more severely, which is sort of what I did. Like when I debated Harry Jaffa in person in California right after my book came out, when they introduced him, they mentioned that his career has been funded by the Carnegie Foundation and the Ford Foundation. And so not only does government finance research by, I don't know if he has been funded by government, but the big foundations, and of course Carnegie and Ford have been criticized by conservatives for decades as being tools of the left wing. But they're also funders of Harry Jaffa's career, who's the preeminent Lincoln idolater, as I call them. Mm-hmm. And so people like that with that sort of financial support aren't used to criticism, because they have the ability actually to finance or at least to subsidize careers of dozens of other people who will be their followers. It takes a lot of money to do that. They'll make them Lincoln Fellows at the Claremont Institute,
yeah.
and rely on them to go out there and defend them whenever a controversy comes up. But and people have talked to me about this. How do you? Aren't you worn down with like 30 or 40 of these people scrutinizing every word?
Yeah.
Right. And
remarkable.
I just tell them, well, I've got them all cornered now. Then I know who they are, uh-huh. and I've got them cornered.
It's
the way I look at it.
It you make it seem easy, but it's very difficult. And a scholar with less maturity and less courage than you would have collapsed under the pressure a lot.
Well, thanks for the compliment, but that's the way I've always been, and
yeah.
You're right. Most people are too intimidated. That's why. If you look at all the people who call themselves libertarians and who write on issues related to this history, economic history, very very few will even touch this topic. And my opinion of why that is that their first and foremost goal is to be acceptable to the mainstream. In academia, that means left-wingers. And so, but I don't care about that. And I look at people like Murray Rothbard as my inspiration, and Ludwig von Mises, who pursued truth and weren't so interested in how their socialist colleagues will look at them. Or whether or not they can get these people to write blurbs for their next book. I'm not concerned about that. I don't care if James McPherson doesn't write a blurb on my next book. Jeffrey Hummel may care, but I don't care about that sort of thing. And so you have a lot of so-called libertarians even who not only will stay away from these topics, but they will actually criticize those of us libertarians who do get involved in these topics. And I think it's a way of just scoring points with their people they want to kiss up to in academia and elsewhere, who are in the mainstream, and I think it's kind of pathetic. But there used to be a vigorous intellectual part of libertarianism or classical liberalism that understood about and wrote about states' rights, federalism. Felix Morley, his book Freedom and Federalism, is a great little book on this. But you don't see anything like that coming out of any of the more visible libertarian think tanks or writers anymore, apart from me.
But you're doing your part to bring it back, and We're grateful to you for teaching this week at the Mises U, where you're mostly talking about economics, not about history.
That's right. To me, this is Mecca. I enjoy coming to Mecca, even though it's a hassle going through those transportation security bureaucrats at the Atlanta airport. It's worth coming to Mecca. Mecca on the Chattahoochee, maybe we can call it someday.
Well, thank you very much for visiting with us today.
My pleasure. Lorenzo.